thanks for coming. This has been a fun couple of days, and if you're like me, you're pretty tired by this time. But we'll see if we can generate enough energy here to get through this session. My name is Bob Keeley, and I'm on the education faculty here at Calvin College. I've been richly blessed to be an associate of the Institute of Christian Worship for the last 8 or 9 years or so. Hanging around with people who have their lives wrapped around worship has some interesting side benefits. If you're watching movies with some of these folks and Yoda says, "May the Force be with you," the room says it also with you. But aside from that, there's some other really good benefits, and this symposium is certainly one of them. This has been a great opportunity for us to gather together. It's been especially fun for me for a couple of reasons. First of all, my daughter led a session, which is kind of fun, and she's here now, so I'll let you see if you can figure out who she is. She's the one who looks really embarrassed. So they flew her up from Georgia to lead a session about postmodern things. She also led the alternative worship service last night. And then my other daughter played viola in the chapel for worship yesterday and today. So, and my wife is here participating in the symposium, and she and I did one of the chapters in the, what is that other book called? God, I forget. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Church of All Ages, or something like that. We read through a couple. That's the one, yeah. It has been a long week, and tomorrow's not a day off. So thank you so much for coming here. We want to spend some time this morning talking about nurturing kids in their faith in worship and making a church-friendly culture. I have a friend who's I actually live in Holland, Michigan, where my wife and I direct children's ministries together at our 14th Street Christian Reformed Church there. And I have a friend who is a biology professor at Holt College. And he suffers from Parkinson's disease. And over the 15 years that I've known him, it's been sad to watch his body deteriorate and degenerate. And you know, what started out as just a shake in his left hand makes it difficult for him to walk. And when he really has to get somewhere and people are watching, he does it in a wheelchair because it's so difficult. And about 5 years ago, he was still doing pretty good. He was walking well, but he occasionally got stuck. Parkinson's disease is a disease that affects the way your brain communicates with your body. And he could not convince his legs to move. There was no physical reason why they couldn't move. He just couldn't get himself to move. And he came up with a variety of tricks to get himself to start doing that. Well, it was New Year's Day in Holland, Michigan. I would ask you to imagine what it's like in January in Holland, but I'm not sure that you'd have to spend a whole lot of time imagining that. It's much like this, except Holland gets more snow. Because we have lake effect snow, really, we do. And so he decided, being a biologist, that New Year's Day was a great day to go to his office and get some work done undisturbed. Science professors, you know, professors themselves are a little bit strange. Science professors bring it up a notch. And so he asked his wife to drop him off at the science building. And at Hope College, there's a large cement flight of stairs up to the doors that lead into it. So his wife dropped him off, and she took off to run some errands or go back home or something like that. He lived, you know, about a half mile away, maybe a mile away. And he walks up the stairs, gets to the door, and he's surprised that the door is locked. He's a biologist. And so he turns around, and he knows that there's another door with a key entry, a card, that he can swipe it and get in. But he has to go down the stairs and around the block, and it's not too bad a walk on a winter day, but it's not a great walk. And he turns around, and he's stuck. He can't get himself to move. Well, he's on a 6-foot landing. He knows if he can get to the steps, he'll be okay. He says if the whole world was steps, he'd be in good shape. And then he says, of course, all of us would be in good shape if the whole world was steps. So he manages to sort of wiggle himself from the door to the edge of the steps, going perhaps a millimeter in a step, gets to the top of the steps, and he starts walking down, and he's feeling a lot better about this. He gets to the bottom of the steps, and he turns the corner, and he's stuck again. And the wind is blowing, and there he stands, and you know, his wife is long gone. And so he's standing there for 5-10 minutes. Across the street are some homes, one of which is owned by another science professor, who comes out and goes over to the building. Now, I don't know if he was going to work in his office too or not, but this other professor, his name is John, comes up to my friend Don and says, "Do you need help?" Don says, "Yeah, I'm stuck. I can't move." And John says, "What can I do to help you?" And Don says, "Well, let's establish one thing right off the bat. Don't just give me a push, because that's not actually going to accomplish anything." He says, and Don has had all of these different things to get himself to start walking. One of my favorites was he had one of those little laser pointers. And he would point at the ground and step on it. And that stepping on it would trick him into walking. He was doing that for a while. He had some other things. And the one that had been working most recently is he had a metronome. And that tick would get him walking. So he says to John, "You know, I've been using this metronome lately." And John says, "Great, where is it?" "It's at home." So they think for a second, and John says, "Does it have to be a metronome?" Don says, "No, it doesn't. In fact, I discovered that this worked because a commercial came on television and I started walking to the beat of the music." So John said, "What if I sing to you?" And so John had just the day before been in children's worship, learned a song about the animals marching two by two, and he started singing this song, this very rhythmic song, to Don, and the two of them started walking. And they walked down the sidewalk together, around the corner and down, and once Don got going, he was fine, but John made sure he got all the way to his office without problem. There's this wonderful image of these two science professors, one singing to the other this song about Noah and the Ark. That's what we need to do for our children. We need to walk with them and sing to them. How can we do that in our church? That's one of the things that I want to talk about with you this morning. We want to create a culture in our church so that children's faith is nurtured, so that they feel like they have a place, and so that their faith can grow. We want church to be not just our place where they visit, but their place too. And by walking with them and singing to them, we can do that. The handout that you got, by the way, has, when I make references to things, I try really hard to get most of those references on there. I usually don't have handouts, and I discovered this week why. It's because I don't like to settle 2 days ahead of time on exactly what I'm going to do. So I think I got most of them in there, but we'll see what happens. As I mentioned, my wife and I have been in our church for about 16 years as directors of children's ministries. We've actually been in the church for about 17 and a half years. The director of children's ministries left, and they asked us if we would fill in for a year. And that was 16 years ago. We have to laugh, by the way, because they asked us to fill in just as our youngest daughter was born. And then other staff members come, they get maternity leave. We started as our child was being born. But changing a culture takes time. Now, our church had a pretty child-friendly culture to begin with. But it seems to us that it really takes about a decade for a church to change a culture. So think in terms of small steps. Think in terms of what little things can you do that's going to start to change the way that the rest of the adults, if they're not already thinking about children, will be thinking about children. Because the default in our churches is that we've got worship, we've got all these things that are for the adults, and we have this for kids. Okay? In many churches, we have this for the adults, we have this for the teens, we have this for kids. And what I want to suggest is if you are thinking more holistically, and I'm not saying get rid of Sunday school or get rid of youth group, but if you're thinking more holistically, then that child-friendly culture can take root more. Don't try and do too much too soon, otherwise you're going to have backlash and angry people. I've heard it said that the only people who really like change in church are the ones who are in the nursery. There are a couple of flawed assumptions, things that I want to sort of get out on the table and say that I don't think these are true. And I'm pretty sure that you don't think these are true either. But sometimes articulating the things that you don't think are true make you realize that maybe you've been working under those assumptions without thinking about them. These three actually come from Children Matter, by Scotty May and her her associates. Scotty's at Wheaton College. And Catherine Stonehouse is at Asbury Seminary. The first one, and this has kind of a yellow tint to it, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's the connection or if it's... Well, when it gets to the pictures, you'll just have to put your colored glasses on and get the colors right. The first one, worship is an adult activity that should meet the needs and interests of that population. Okay, so if you think worship is an adult activity, I think that's a flawed assumption. One of the problems that can come with this assumption is that you get the tyranny of the excellent. The worship services here are worth the trip, right? They're so incredibly well crafted and so well done. I was struck with that again this morning. I went to the chapel yesterday and was just astonished at the beautiful way that thing was assembled and how well the college students in particular did in presenting this. The Fine Arts Center worship was of a completely different nature, and there we were led beautifully with just a voice and a drum. It was just so wonderful that when we have that standard, then involving children can really only mean that they don't do it as well. And so, of course, we want to do our best job. But we don't want to do the best job ever. We want to do our best job, right? And our best job might mean that Sally stumbles as she reads Scripture. Reverent worship is beyond children's abilities and will bore them. I disagree with that. I think children can be reverent. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily experience reverent worship the same way that we do. And there's a time and a place for worship that is specifically at even the developmental level of children. In one of the chapters of the other book that you got, if you got here early enough, Helping Our Children Grow in Faith, and if you didn't get here early enough to get it for free, go buy multiple copies. It's great. If one of the chapters in there talks about how I think we should worship together, that it's really, really important that our children be in worship with us. But also there is a time and a place to have them worship in a way that's developmentally appropriate. I don't think we have to have an either or. I think we can have both and. The third assumption is that worship for children must be fun, active, and entertaining. There's nothing wrong with fun in church. There can be fun, there can be activity, and in fact there is adult activity, right? We as adults are active in our adult way. When we get together with adult friends, we don't go out and run around and play on the swings and that kind of stuff. We sit and talk. Well, that's what we do in church. That's adult activity. So children's worship does not have to be more active than adult worship. Sometimes it might have to be different active. It doesn't necessarily have to be entertaining. Children can enter into a deep, reverent worship experience. So now that I've got those out of the way, let me make sure that I haven't skipped anything really important. Even though if it was really important, I probably would have said it anyway. Okay. So the first thing that I think is helpful in helping children create, or helping us create a child-friendly culture, is to think of children as family rather than potential members. When we bring children into our family, they grow up, they hear our stories, they experience life as part of it. We don't bring them into our family and then at age 10 or 12 ask them a series of questions, and if they answer I do, then we make them members of the family. They're part of our family even before they're born. And I think sometimes we treat children like potential members. So we sort of keep them at arm's length until they do something. That's I think, a bad idea. They need to be part of the ebb and flow of the congregation. Here's an example. I think children's prayers, let's face it, many of our prayers fall into two categories. Help me and thank you. And the prayers in worship are broader than that. Do we ever help children understand that, either by the way that we introduce those prayers in worship or what we do with them outside of worship? What if we asked children to be part of the leadership for the prayer of illumination? If we met with children, if we took a child and said, here is this time in worship when we recognize that we can't really understand God's word unless the Spirit helps us to do that. And that's why we ask God to be with us as those who hear his word and with the person who delivers his word. And we ask the Spirit to do that. Will you write a prayer with me like that, that you could then say on Sunday morning? What if we told the whole congregation about this and said, when you go home, think about asking God to open your ears and your hearts before you hear the word. In the tradition I grew up in, it was you eat, and then you read the Bible, and then you pray. Usually in that order, right? What if we switched the last two around? What if we prayed and then read the Bible? That little turn, which could easily come from church, right? If as a congregation we said, hey, think about this with your kids, that little turn could not only help us do some good theological instruction at home, but it would make a strong connection between what's going on in church and at home. I think there are some challenges, by the way, in megachurch contemporary worship, which my understanding of and the ones I've seen tend to be a half hour of singing and then 45 minutes to an hour of preaching. That's been the liturgy for many of these churches. Where are the kids in these churches? In my experience, they're often in a different room somewhere. They never actually even get into the sanctuary. When they get to the lobby, there's a special place that they go. I think that's a real challenge for contemporary churches. I think that they need to be working, and maybe we need to be working with them, to say, how can kids be part of this? And ironically, one of the things that these churches do that may have originally been in order to attract the young people, and that is projecting the words on the screen, can be something that actually works against children. Think about it. You're standing in your pews or your bench, and you're all standing up, and here's Jimmy next to you. And what does he see? He sees the back of the person ahead of him, right? So now, in some churches, the kids readily climb on the pew. But even with that, that gets them up to about here and doesn't really help. So those are the sorts of things that are a particular challenge for some styles of worship, right? There are other challenges for very liturgical worship that we can talk about as well. But in a sense, I think the challenges are less great there because they've got some things inherent that are very child-friendly. Emerging worship. Worship that is like the alternative service that we had here last night. Tends to be, and of course this is sweeping generalization, and all sweeping generalizations have issues, including this one. Where's the place for children in that sort of worship? How are they going to be drawn in? I think that emergent worship tends to be 20-somethings who are planning it and participating in it with a few old people hanging out because they usually pay the bills. There was a church that was here in Grand Rapids for a while. It was trying to do some cutting edge stuff, and it attracted all sorts of college students. There was about four families that paid for everything. And that was just the nature of the church. And they didn't feel bad about that at all. That was their ministry. But if they had left and just left it to the young people, they just didn't have the finances to pull it off. How can emerging worship enfold children? I'm not sure that one's really been thought through very carefully yet. We want to make sure that we involve all children. Here's the counterexample, the best Christmas pageant ever. Have any of you ever seen or read that book? It's a wonderful children's book. And it's about, it's written from the perspective of a little girl whose mother is in charge of the Christmas program. How many of you are in charge of the Christmas program at your church? That's a horrible experience, isn't it? It really is. When my wife and I took the job at our church, there's like seven things on the job description. All of them are very general. Advocate for the children. There's put on the Sunday school Christmas program. That's like the one thing that's actually listed in our job description, because nobody else wants to do it. This little girl's mother is in charge of the Sunday school Christmas program. And she is quite sure that she's going to be Mary, because she looks just like Mary looked. And she's this beautiful, perfect little girl, and everything is, she is going to be Mary. This has been preordained. She must have been a Calvinist. And what happens is, when the time comes to hand out the parts, the Herdmans show up. The Herdmans are this family of ragamuffins who don't really belong to the church, but they're sort of in the neighborhood, and the kids show up, and the little Herdman girl gets the part of Mary. And this girl is just devastated, and the whole book has her sort of making snarky comments along the way, and it's a wonderful look inside the head of this little girl and look inside the making of Christmas programs, and it's just a fun book. But my point here is that there was a star. There's actually two stars in the Christmas story. There's the star, and then there's Mary, who's the star of the Christmas play, right? If we've got a star, all the other kids aren't. So can we develop things where we don't feature a kid? Now, our church is has around 100 families, which is a really nice size for involving and knowing all the kids. And so when my wife and I have been writing our Christmas plays, because we couldn't find other ones that we liked, we actually count kids and we count lines. And so we've sort of established that the sixth graders, and this is our preschool through sixth grader puts on the Christmas play, our sixth graders get the larger parts. And we make sure that all the larger parts are around the same size. Then there's the parts that aren't quite as big. Those go to our fifth graders and fourth graders. Our third graders and our second graders read the Bible passages, and the younger kids sing. We have never announced that, but the kids know it, because they've been watching this happen for all these years. We've been at this for a long time now, and they know it. And you know that we hand out their parts about 15 minutes into our 45-minute Sunday school session. Within 20 minutes of that Sunday school session, they have counted the lines, and they know how many lines they have and how many lines their friends have. It's important to them. But it's been an interesting thing that's happened over the years that we've been doing this, because we've been so careful about this, and because we try to make it a really low-stress play. We hand the play out the Sunday before it's given. The next Sunday morning, the morning of the play, we have our first rehearsal. We do one run-through. The kids read their parts. They've got it on music stands. You know, it gets a lot better the second time through. Third and fourth time, the change is minimal, so we figure, why don't just let the people sing the second time through? And we surround them with a great cloud of adults who help them. So we've got someone sitting in the front row holding up a little sign that says, "Derek and Annie, go to the back room now." We have someone in the back handing them their scripts with the type blown up so that they can just go and set it on music stands. We've got microphones there. We've got a great guy who works our microphones, who works really hard to make sure all the kids are heard. And they walk out there, and we've got these Israelite costumes that are way too big for them. And they come out, and they read their part. And we do that for the evening service. We call each kid the week before you have the part and say, "Are you willing to have a part?" And in 10 years, we've maybe had two kids say no. And those are kids that we expected to say no because of their nature. And most of the time, those kids eventually say yes, even though that we don't put any pressure on them at all. The nightmare, of course, is when a kid says no, and then the day you hand out the parts, the mom calls and says, can you have a part for him after all?
Right.
Because we actually change the number of parts. If we have too many sixth graders, we'll look at our play and say, okay, we need to add another part. And so we split the lines up, or we add somebody who says, "Really? Is that what he said?" You know, things like that. Sort of filler lines. I mean, it's not Shakespeare, but it gets the job done. And the kids feel like they have a place in this part. There's none of this sniping about, you know, did I get the big part? Who's going to get the big part? That sort of thing. All of our third graders take part in being the acolytes. We have, well, I do have a picture of that, actually. My first picture. This is dangerous, if I can get to this screen again that I'm at right now. But we have our third graders lighting the candle at the beginning of worship. Now, this typically was not in our tradition, so this was sort of a big step for us. having even kids wear the stole, you know, that's, candles, is that too Catholic? All right. But at the beginning of worship, during one of the opening songs, two children walk down the aisle wearing stoles that match the colors of the season. They carry the thurifer, that's the big stick with the light on the end. They carry that thing. One lights the candle, and the other one brings in the Bible and sets it on the pulpit. After church, during the final song, those same two children come in. They relight the thurifer, snuff out the candle, and bring the light and the scripture out into the world, and we follow them. And every kid is on the schedule. We make a schedule so that they all know they're going to get a chance. It is so much fun to watch these kids. You know, they come down, they're holding this thurifer very carefully, they're walking down, and their shoes are blinking because they light up. It is God's people being who they are, worshiping Him and leading the congregation in worship. My wife and I get to stand in the back of the sanctuary because we have to catch the kids when they're dismissed for children's worship, so we make sure that we don't have any strays. And so I get to see this from a unique perspective. And what most people don't realize is the last two or three rows, the kid with the thurifer is going a little bit faster and the other kid's trying to blow it out. They are third graders, right? They're doing their job in a very reverent way, but they continue to be third graders. And I just absolutely love that. Let's see if I can get back to close there. Okay. One other quick example. We asked our children to create artwork about Christmas that we could show on the screen. And we made sure that we asked them at a time when all the kids could participate, and then we used all the artwork. Not only the ones like this that are pretty nice, although I'm not sure if Joseph just won an Olympic medal or what's going on there, but here's another. These are just very evocative of the Christmas season. Here's someone who even quoted Isaiah. Aaron did. There's one with a Christmas turkey, and I'm not quite sure what that was about. And you can see some do better than others, right? Rowan expressed herself in a way that was very much like Rowan. There's an angel, sort of. There's a better turkey though. There she is. I think it's supposed to be an angel, but you know, the point is here that this is just as evocative of Christmas as some of the great art that our culture has ever produced. And this is stuff that, as it's being shown on the screen, the children are thrilled because they are part of it. Well, let me move on. I think it's important that kids have authentic tasks. Authentic tasks are defined as things that you have to actually get somebody else to do if the person who's assigned it can't do it. Okay, if it's just frilly and they're not there to say, okay, we can do without it, then it's not an authentic task. One of the authentic tasks that young people have done in our church is running the audiovisual stuff. I mentioned that we've got a midlife adult single man who runs our audiovisual stuff, and about, 6 or 7 years ago, he recruited a couple of high school boys to run sound. And they stepped up to the plate big time. They took ownership of that. They were showing up to church 30, 35 minutes early to make sure that everything was set up. They actually got serious about thinking about what does it mean to make that enhance worship. Well, when those boys graduated, a couple of girls, one of whom was my youngest, decided that it just did not make sense that only boys did that. So now most of our team is young women. It's girls. And so we have this 40-something-year-old single guy who has this team of high school kids that he works with on a consistent basis. They do a great job. And frankly, if it wasn't for the high school kids, I don't know if we would have amplification on some Sundays because we just don't have enough adults who are willing to do it. So that's one way that we can do it. Worship leadership, actually doing the stuff that goes on in worship. If you have lay people reading scripture or leading music or leading in the prayer, consider having children do that. But you can't, of course, just sort of ask a kid to do it. You've got to sort of grow with them. Let me read you something, if I can find the page. It's out of this book, which some of you got.
What is the book?
This is Helping Our Children Grow in Faith.
Do you have it out here?
No, I don't think I did, but I assume that everybody would get one.
Yeah.
It's the reflection by, I think she was 20 at the time, a young woman who's actually in this room right now, so I won't embarrass her even further. She had to do a speech of appreciation for a class. She was a communication major, and so she chose to write about what happened as she was growing up in church. Here's what she wrote. I gained confidence as a musician from a very young age, singing and playing the violin in church with my family and with my friends. If it wasn't for the friendliness of my church, I might never have had the courage to sing in public or to play violin without music in front of me. And if it wasn't for the encouragement of church members, I might not have had the confidence to continue to develop those gifts elsewhere. Now, leading worship musically is among the most fulfilling things I do. The community was more important than perfection. So out-of-tune violin duets and pre-adolescent singing groups and hesitant readings were all treasured as bringing what we have to the glory of God. And as we grew up, these childish offerings became more mature gifts, partly because of experience and practice. So not only are we valuing the children as they are, but we are preparing the future leaders of worship. And we can't stop that too early. I mentioned taking part in ritual. I think I just have a picture of the kids doing that. There's another picture of the kids leaving the sanctuary. And you can see, can you see the expression on Margaret's face here? She's already eyeing that to see if she can get that blown out. I thought that was a pretty good one. I forgot to show this picture yesterday. I don't know why I forgot to show this one, but here we changed the colors when the seasons change. One of the things that we started doing just a year ago was we had a Christmas Eve candlelight service, and the church is decorated for Advent. And then Sunday morning for Christmas, we had the children come in and change the colors at the beginning of the service. This year, one of our third graders is a young boy named Dalton. Dalton was born microcephalic. He has a very small brain, and he's non-communicative. He sits in a wheelchair. But Dalton has been part of our fellowship all along, and we've tried really hard to make him part of us and not just, set off someplace. And so the kids know Dalton. He's been sitting in children's worship with them, with a helper. We've got a group of people who volunteer to be Dalton's friends, and so every Sunday morning they sit with Dalton in children's worship or in church school so that he's there. He can hear the sounds. He responds to the sounds. He can't speak. He can't see. But the kids know him. And this year, Dalton was a third grader. And so they put the colors on Dalton's lap in the wheelchair, and the kids wheeled him in, and he was part of that. During the song, I've got to tell you, there was not much singing going on because all of us were just sort of... It was such an amazing experience. But this is what I love. You see how these kids are? They're doing this deep liturgical work, and there they are, sitting there, holding this stuff up. I didn't put in the picture of this little boy taking the stole and making it like a beard because I didn't want to seem too irreverent. But that's the sort of stuff that they do if we give them the chance. There they are changing the colors. I'm sorry, that's sort of hard to see. I didn't want to have a flash go off in the back of church. So, readings. If you look in the back of one of the appendices of Helping Our Children Grow in Faith, there is something that my wife and my pastor, Mark Hoffman, and I put together to try and help congregation make sense of Paul's fifth missionary journey. It's this list of places and names, and it's just sort of hard to get a hold of. So we wrote something for our middle school kids to help us figure out. And here's what it looked like at the time. They traveled to a different town, we had them actually stand by the the signs with the names on it. And they read it. These were our 7th and 8th graders who were doing that. The one in the black in the front, by the way, is my youngest daughter, Lene. She hates it when I show middle school pictures of her. So if you, she's around here today, so if you see her, tell her that she looks much more mature now. But that's, one of the challenges in doing this was because, of course, there's lots of words here that are difficult. But we made sure that in the readings, we had them do maybe 2 or 3 sentences at a time. You give a 7th grader a paragraph, and they're in deep trouble. You give them 2 or 3 sentences, and they can do it pretty easily. Mentoring in general, and then I'll talk about mentoring in a minute. Kids mentoring kids. One of the things that our predecessor at our church started, which I thought was brilliant, is she asked in sort of way our middle school kids to be our helpers in our children's worship services. So our 7th and 8th graders are going through children's worship again. But this time, we're meeting with them first and saying, here's what your role is. You're helping these children worship. So you have to try and help them sit still. If during response time they're doing something that's not constructive, sit alongside them and work on this. It's our subliminal way of having them go through children's worship again. And they rotate on the schedule. So they're in children's worship for 4 weeks, and they're in congregational worship for about 8 weeks at a time. But the benefit of this that was unexpected, for me at least, was that this formed a connection between those middle school kids and those young children. And sometimes that connection just kept going. They got to know them. And so rather than just being little kids who were around, they were specific kids with whom they already had a relationship. So many of our kids, by the time they get to high school, they volunteer to be leaders in our Boys and Girls Club program that meets during the week. It was great fun for me. We went to our Pinewood Derby to see my son Brian sitting on the sidelines with an autistic 7th grader next to him and a kindergartner on his lap. And I said to him later, Brian, that was really nice that you hung out with CJ, because he can really, you know, get on your nerves after a while. He says, you know what, I figured he'd be with me anyway and then we'll just enjoy it. But because he's known CJ for years, you know, since Brian was young, that sort of mentoring was built in and that happened. We've done some, and I say we, by which I mean other people. I should say that many of my best ideas come from my wife. She would say it even more strongly. And this is certainly one of them. We have a sanctuary that's separated from the foyer by 6 windows. And so a couple of years ago, my wife and a couple of other women in the church who are very artistic decided that we should use those windows to hold art to help us better understand Lent as a congregation. Now, now you need to know the backstory here, too. And by the way, I'm using my church as an example because that's the one I know. It's just like your church. I'm just telling you the good stuff, right? There were coffee tables in front of these windows. We moved the coffee tables. I'm telling you, Vatican II was nothing compared to the moving of the coffee tables. It was just, it was a big deal. But we wanted there to be a starkness in that foyer at the beginning of Lent. And then every week we added to a window. So let me quickly go through this. This is showing hands. We asked the children to come. We took pictures of their hands in various poses. And then we took one of those pictures, and one of the women did an artistic rendering of that. I'm sorry, this is kind of hard to see. It would take me 10 minutes to figure out how to dim the lights. This cross was made by the children. They cut out pictures of faces and put those on there, and then they did the red wash over top of it. Ooh, good one. If you can get this half of the room, that'd be excellent. Well, we'll just keep going, and we'll see what happens. Here's a crown of thorns. So the adults made the crown, right, and the children decorated it. Here is the money that Judas spilled out. The kids sewed these burlap bags. These were chocolate coins And the children, we gave them the onerous task of extracting the chocolate and leaving the wrapper. We really had to twist their arm to come after church to work on that one. Here are our palm branches painted on by an adult, and then the children cut out and decorated the cloaks. Let me show you what this scale is. There's Eli when he was two. That's how big that was. And all of those children's cloaks were there, adding to that artistic expression. On another Lent, we got this actually out of a Reformed Worship article, and I have that listed here where it is. The kids actually placed all of these fabric squares. Okay, the adults cut them out, and we had them there, and we had the fabric, and we had some string that said, okay, we want the maroon ones here, the purple ones here, the red ones here, and the blue ones here, and the kids placed them on there. Those were all little crosses, right? There's a second one as well. There's a front view of that one, and then there's that one as well. And they did it. While we were there, we just ironed it on. We had sticky stuff. This is beyond my technical capabilities. Sticky stuff on the back, so it stuck there. And then my wife did up the seams, and we hung it there. But the kids participated in creating these. Now, we didn't just have kids' art in those windows all the time. During the Epiphany, one of the adults who was very artistic did it, which I think is also important, by the way. These windows should not just be our church refrigerator door, right? If there's some adult art there as well, then that increases the value of the children's art that's there, because that's part of what we do. I really thought this was great. Again, this was not without some consternation on the part of some members of us, but they're getting used to it. So now this Christmas, when we hung these festive things at Advent, adding a string, we added the pink string during one of the weeks when the candle was pink. I discovered, by the way, that there is no standard Advent candle thing. Some people get very attached to the one particular one that they think is the right one, and when you do even just a little bit of research, you find out, no, not so much. So we had those hung across our foyer. There's a little close-up of it, and it was just an opportunity for these kids. They tore some paper, they put some glittery things on there, they put some sparkly stuff on it, put it between two pieces of contact paper, and we hung it from a wire. And of course, this is done with kids, right? So my wife and I very carefully laid out the wire and had it in the room, and one of the children, while he was making it, thinks, oh, that's cool, so he cut a piece of the wire off and made a bracelet out of it. Said, no, that doesn't fit. And here's what it looked like. When we first did the Lenten art, we had it in one of our church school rooms. The kids would come back there. We had a door open to the fellowship room, but the kids were back there. This year we thought, let's get in the adults' way. So that they're part of it, so they see what's happening. So this year, when we made that, we had it right in the fellowship room. So all the adults were milling around, the kids were part of this, their parents were part of it. It really was very much part of our fellowship time after church, the creation of this art. And there's Audrey showing what she created. Okay, mentoring. I've already talked about how we need to walk alongside kids. There are lots of ways that we can be mentors for kids. One of them is in music. As you probably know better than any other audience I could ever talk to, there's a big difference between playing an instrument and leading worship with that instrument. If you have a high school student who's a pretty good pianist come and play for you at night, you're acutely aware of that difference because you don't know when to sing. We had that recently. We've got a high school girl. She's a wonderful musician, but when she plays for us, it's a guessing game when we're supposed to actually start singing. One of the things that Paul Ryan this morning did extremely well is he brought us in when he wanted us to sing in chapel. I'm a guitarist, and that's been one of the things that I've been working on for the last 10 or 15 years. How can I do it so that the congregation better knows how to sing, right? Keyboard players, organists, and pianists have a long history of this. If you have a good one, you know exactly when to come in, and I'll bet you don't even know how you know. They put a breath in there, and you just know you're right there. Well, the guitar, we don't have that long history. We have to kind of figure it out on our own. So that's hard because you need both hands. You know, so you sort of play, and I go like this, and I make big motions, and those sorts of things. That's an important skill that we need to pass on. So if you've got your high school guitar player who now knows all the chords and gets them right most of the time, then we can start saying, now, when you're leading worship, how are people going to know what to sing? How are you going to communicate that to them? Maybe you put a big space, you get to the end, you put a big space, and then you bring them in again. Those are, as you got a piano player, talk about, okay, we're not just playing piano. We're not just accompanying a singer. We're leading the congregation to worship. That sort of mentoring is really important. A friend of mine, his name is Rod Branson. He's a teacher at Holland Christian High School. He remembers when he was in high school, his church had a brass group, and there was an older man who was in charge of all these high school kids who played brass. And apparently they were good enough that they went around to other churches too, and they would play some events or whatever. And this man told each of these kids that you have to have a verse ready so that when I ask you what your favorite Bible verse is, you can tell me. So he would be, you know, up in front maybe at some event, and he'd say, oh, it's really nice to be here with these boys, and well, Rod, why don't you tell us what your favorite Bible verse is and why? And so Rod was suddenly on. He would have to do that. All these years later, I asked Rod what his verse was, and he could not tell me. But he could tell me what the mentor's verse was. Because when you're in high school, you just sort of pick one, right? But that adult who meant so much to him at that point, he can still tell me what that verse, what his verse was. He can quote the verse. He can tell me a lot about what that mentor did. That's really important. I got to take a little detour here and tell you another story that Rod told me because it's just too good. Rod has three children, and when his oldest daughter was about four or five, they had two older girls, high school age, maybe right around high school graduation age, who were members of their church, who had a degenerative illness, who used to come and play with their kids. It was pretty clear that these girls' lives would be short. But they're wonderful girls, and they would get on their three-wheel bikes and bike over to Rod's house to play with his kids. And as one of them got sicker, Sherry, they got sick, went in the hospital, and they went to the hospital to visit her, and then Sherry died. And Rod was putting Jenna to bed, and he said, Jenna, I have to tell you that Sherry went to be with Jesus. She died today. And Jenna just sort of got up and said, well, she didn't say anything at first. And Rod said, but we're going to see her again in heaven. And Jenna said, how are we going to get to heaven? And Rod had one of those, what's the theology here, moments. And then before he could say anything, Jenna said, is Jesus going to drive? Pretty cool. That has nothing to do with this, but I just thought, you know, I think about Rod and I think about that story. I've already talked a little bit about making litanies accessible to children. I want to zip along here. Offer some developmentally appropriate activities. Let's remember that kids think differently than adults do. They've got different developmental needs. So any ways that we can connect home with church, I've already talked about that prayer of illumination thing, other things like that can be really helpful. Let me just say a word about children's sermons. First of all, I think in some ways you almost can't lose with children's sermons. If you have a time where the children are brought forward, and as a church you basically say without saying it, you're important enough that we want to spend some time just with you, that's a win. Now, on the other hand, I've seen an awful lot of children's sermons that managed to almost not make it a win. Because I think too often we don't have a good sense of what children are able to do cognitively. Children don't handle abstraction well. And the object lesson, which is, you know, the sort of the bread and butter of many people's children's sermon, is just developmentally inappropriate for children. And so when you get things like, you know, our prayers are kind of like this remote control. The kids are completely out of it. And so now, sometimes, the irony is the fifth and sixth graders in the bench, they can maybe handle it. But the kids who are up front can't. you know, all know the story, right, of the pastor who said, you know, I'm thinking of something that's it's furry and gray, and it sits up in a tree and it eats nuts. And the kid says, you know, I know the answer is supposed to be God, but it sure sounds like a squirrel to me. We need to think developmentally appropriate with our children's sermons. Children's bulletins, third grade thinking page. In our third grade children's worship, we had children's worship go through second grade, from about 3 years old to second grade. And then we thought, you know, we really do mirror congregational worship in our children's worship with many of the things that we do. We wanted to make sure the kids actually could connect the dots. And so we developed a third grade curriculum. So the kids came to children's worship about half as often. So sometimes the third graders don't leave congregational worship, and sometimes they do. And so they'll leave congregational worship. We'll do our story, which is a set of different stories and a little bit more more developmentally mature. And then we will talk about one of the parts of worship with them. And then when they're in worship the next week, we give them a third grade thinking page, which helps them think about that thing we were talking about. This thinking page was when we were talking about the sermon, which is much like the story that happens in children's worship. And so here we asked Micah, in this case, to write or draw what was happening in this sermon. Let me give you a close-up of this. In this first one, Pilate says, "What should I do?" You can see Pilate there. And here, the crowd, and I love the way he did the crowd. Isn't that great? He says, "Release Barabbas," using the less common spelling of release. Then the crowd says, "Crucify him," and you can, this is maybe hard for you to see, but I think these are the people beating Jesus. Then here, Pilate said, "I should, I guess." And then Pilate said, "Take him away." You think Micah paid attention to the sermon that day? We you know, occasionally, this is confession time. I'll depend on you for assurance in a minute. My mind wanders when I'm hearing sermons. Yours too? Not if you're preaching them? Even if you're preaching them? And then what I have to do is I have to refocus and get myself back in, right? If church is 65 minutes long, I'm tuned in for 55 minutes. Some weeks, 10 minutes, right? I mean, you've been there. I got to tell you, tomorrow morning, I'm doing a baptism candle presentation tomorrow. I've got to prepare songs for an all-campus worship here. I'm leading the band. Our rehearsal's on Monday. I'll be lucky if I get 10 minutes of concentration tomorrow morning, because I'm just a little too wired, right? Do we ever tell kids that? Do we ever give them permission to come back in? No, we just say, sit still. We don't say, boy, I really had a hard time paying attention this morning. And so things like this can help them get those skills. We want to encourage other adults to spend time with kids. There's a book called Hardwired to Connect, and I don't have the reference to that because I added this 2 days ago. Hardwired to Connect is the case for authoritative communities, and I forget the name of the author because it was written by a consortium. But if you Google Hardwired to Connect, you can find out about authoritative communities. And actually, the reference is made explicit in Helping Our Children Grow in Faith. So it's in the bibliography there. This is a group that looked at the growing crisis among young people in our country. Not a Christian organization. And they said that the problem is we don't have enough authoritative communities anymore. And when you look at their definition of authoritative communities, which we don't have time to go through, it is also in the book. You can see that it was a lot like church. Yeah. And I think if we allow adults other than parents to connect with kids, then we're really scoring well. One way we can do that is through prayer partners or mentors. We've talked about some mentoring things already. One of the things that has been hit and miss, frankly, at our church is prayer partners. Our kids are assigned a prayer partner when they're seventh graders, and those prayer partners often go all the way through to when they graduate from high school. I think Bethany's was a miss, wasn't it, Bethany? Your prayer partner? Okay, yeah, that's right. Yours was, it was another daughter who was a miss. My youngest daughter, though, got really blessed. I almost said got really lucky. I realized I was in a church group. Got really blessed with a prayer partner who is just fabulous. She's an older woman, former Hope College professor. She's a widow. She thinks about Lene a lot. When she's off traveling the world somewhere, she goes out and does mission projects on her own. She sends a postcard or writes a letter. When there's a play in Holland that she thinks Lene would like to go to, they go together. When Lene had to do a project for Bible class at school, and it was write about some adult whose faith has influenced hers. And so she chose Mary, and the two of them went out for coffee. It was great because they talked about Mary's life instead of Lene's life for a change. Right? When Lene was an eighth grader, our church was doing 40 Days of Purpose, and so she decided she would be to read that too. She opened it up, read the first sentence, closed the book, and said, "This book was not meant for middle school kids." Remember the first sentence? It's not about you. Share stories of faith. We share, of course, the biblical story, which is the primary story, but we have faith stories as well. We have times in our life when God was very real to us. They don't have to be Damascus Road experiences. They can just be the stuff that happens to us on a weekly basis. We need to share those with kids. And if we build in some opportunities in worship for those things to happen, I think that can be really helpful. I mentioned some Reformed worship articles, I think, somewhere on there. The first of those is a way to connect the Advent candle litany with testimonies. When you take people and say, "Give your testimony," they don't know how to do that, right? Most people, and frankly, some of them give you 20 minutes when you really wanted three. And so you need to structure it in a way. Maybe interview that person. Maybe say, "Will you please just write out a paragraph that you can maybe read during this?" Find some way to get those testimonies out, and then see if you can encourage parents to give their testimonies to their kids at home. There's some research that says that something like 80 or 90% of kids who grow up in Christian homes never ever hear their parents talk about their faith. We want kids to see that church, that their faith is much more than just at church. And I'm going to risk going a minute over and read The Runaway Bunny to you. To show them that we want them to see the sacred and the secular. The Runaway Bunny by Margaret Wise Brown is a very old book, 1920-something, I think. I had a group in here yesterday who there was a simultaneous translation going on into Japanese. They knew this book, too. That was kind of fun. So, okay. I only have the color picture scanned except for this one to show you what the rest of the book is like. I figured if I did this, you wouldn't see it at all. Once there was a little bunny who wanted to run away. So he said to his mother, "I am running away." "If you run away," said his mother, "I will run after you, for you are my little bunny." "If you run after me," said the little bunny, "I will become a fish in a trout stream, and I will swim away from you." "If you become a fish in a trout stream," said his mother, "I will become a fisherman, and I will fish for you." That's how old this book is, by the way. They only have the occasional color pages in there. "If you become a fisherman," said the bunny, "I will become a rock on a mountain high above you." "If you become a rock on a mountain high above me," said his mother, "I will be a mountain climber, and I will climb to where you are." "If you become a mountain climber," said the little bunny, and those of us who are in education realize this is a predictable reader, "I will be a crocus in a hidden garden." "If you become a crocus in a hidden garden," said his mother, "I will be a gardener, and I will find you." "If you become a gardener and find me," said the little bunny, "I will be a bird and fly away from you." "If you become a bird and fly away from me," said his mother, "I will be a tree that you come home to." "If you become a tree," said the little bunny, "I will become a little sailboat, and I'll sail away from you." "If you become a sailboat and sail away from me," said his mother, "I will become the wind and blow you where I want you to go." "If you become the wind and blow me," said the little bunny, "I will join a circus and fly away on a flying trapeze." "If you go flying on a flying trapeze," said his mother, "I will be a tightrope walker, and I will walk across the air to you." "If you become a tightrope walker and walk across the air," said the bunny, "I will become a little boy and run into a house." If you become a little boy and run into a house, said the mother bunny, I will become your mother and catch you in my arms and hug you. Shucks, said the bunny. I might just as well stay where I am and be your bunny. And so he did. Have a care, said the mother bunny. Psalm 139 says, O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know where when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all of my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Throw my buddy, isn't it? If we help kids see that their faith doesn't end at the four walls of the church, I think we're allowing them to see that God is part of the bigger world. I'm sorry there's not time for group questions, but I'm happy to stick around for a while. Thank you so much for coming.